personally, I think there is always a big squabble about what constitutes the best time of the day to have a thing like this. You know, when you turn out all the lights, and then people are supposed to focus on a bright spot. The 8:30 class in the morning, it doesn't matter what you have to focus on or whether you turn the lights off or on, it's just a bummer altogether. So you just kind of, nobody wants that. The hour right before lunch, everybody's thinking about lunch. And the hour right after lunch, everybody is kind of full and sleepy and content. And so that's bad. And that leaves either 2 o'clock in mid-afternoon, and if it's a nice day, that's terrible, or it leaves around 10 o'clock in the morning. We're not at a good start. I think of a whole day of activities. I think of Mary kind of summing up the thoughts of the day for us, and maybe it's time in which we should all go back and think quiet thoughts and that as well. But it was the time available, and there was a request that we spend at least some time this week thinking about the relationship of art and the church. I worded it specifically that way, art and the church. We had offered for many years a course of operation that I taught called Christian Art. And I spent about the first week and a half apologizing for the name of the course. I personally don't think there is any such thing as Christian Art, which is maybe something that ought to be explained. I guess a lot depends on your own definitions of things, and we should throw around words with rather reckless abandon, and before we get started, maybe it would be good for you to acquaint yourself with my particular symbol. Christian, I think, is whatever has Christ in the midst.
But he never said, you see, where 2 or 3 altars are gathered in my name, or 2 or 3 organs, 2 or 3 stained glass windows, 2 or 3 anything but people. And so I kind of just simply decided for myself, it's a rather arbitrary and untheological decision because I don't have that kind of a background, but I decided for myself just not to hook up the word Christian with art. I know it's common, and there are books and books written about it. I just don't choose to use it. So art done for the church, and it's a problem. Art done by whom? I mean, are you going to allow art done by really lousy people? You know, among the whole history of art and artists, there are a few that crept in that were not what you would call virtuous folks, and they got themselves some commissions to work for churches. Do you count that as art for the church? Or a guy like Rembrandt, who was not only a pretty decent guy, but did what we would call, I think, some fairly religious things, never got any commissions for the church. Not one church hired him to do a job in his whole lifetime. That's weird. That's kind of strange. And he was coming pretty cheap toward the end there. So, you know, what do we even include in a thing that is as broad and rather nebulous as art for the church? I don't want to get into a long harangue and discussion about it. The church, the Christian church, has a history. And throughout that history, it has been compelled to give an account of the hope that is in it, depending on social impetuses, depending on the kinds of people that were gathered in a unique place, depending upon traditions and forms that were customary in a certain area. It has always been asked and felt compelled to give an account visually of the hope that was in it. And so the history of the relationship between art and the Christian church is terribly rich. Let me say, before we begin looking, you know, turning out the lights, I want to get as much in before I do that. I suppose that just simply by way of introducing you to who I am, it would be good for you to know that I am a traditional artist. The only difference between my tradition and most traditions is that I go all the way back. Most of our traditions, I think, tend to go back to around 1928. That was a good year. But in the history of art and the church, it left something to be desired. For example, out of a couple hundred building committees that I have been, I was going to say honored, but the word is forced to work with over the years, I can't think of one other single common denominator for their particular building program than this one, and that was that it looked like a church. I mean, we don't care what you do. You know, you go as far out as you want, just so that when you're done, it looks like a church. And, of course, my question is, unfortunately, sarcastic. I always tend to do that and then get myself in trouble. But I have to ask, which one? Which church is it that you want it to look like? Because everybody's got it in mind. I mean, it's back there somewhere. When they say look like a church, they don't say I want it to look like the church, you know, which is a lot of people going around in the community doing what they've been called to do. That's what the church looks like. But it's, I want it to look like a church. And only they know what a is. And that a usually goes, as I say, back to 1928, depending upon the typical building committee. If it is an older building committee, then the tradition will go back to 1871, and if we're in real good luck, we'll have somebody there that read a book, and we might come up with a Hallkirche. It's really strange. And so I think one of the things that we want to have happen over the next four evenings, over the next any evening, hopefully, but it's going to be spread out over a fairly long package, is that you somehow get a sense of the historical importance of the reason behind what these people were doing. If the early Christian had built according to our present-day standards, and each consecutive order had designed according to what we require today, most of us, for our churches, we would still all have to be worshiping in catacombs. I am not saying that that day isn't going to come. For some of us, it may come sooner than for others.
see you all in about half an hour, okay? All right. The early
church.
You got a savior and you got disciples.
Okay? You with me? You've got a whole bunch of people needing to get close to the action. There is a whole new setup being started. The Savior dies. He rises from the dead. He works and lives among his followers. And then he ascends into heaven, leaving his followers to hit the road two by two and build up the church, baptizing, preaching, etc., etc. They cross oceans. They get stoned. I mean, in the New Testament tradition. It's that kind of group, isn't it? Well, this is well, we got the lights out. Okay, and they are persecuted. They build up immediately a really lively history for themselves. And the kingdom expands, it grows, it's a tremendous thing. There are outposts of the faithful throughout North Africa, the Middle East, Rome, and a few other places that Paul sent letters to. It was important, very, very important for these early Christians that they get close to the source of their faith life. These people were converts. Now, I'm sure, I don't know if we have any converts in our midst. I'm sure there are some, although not necessarily. There is nothing quite so active, quite so intense as a convert. As a person who comes to his faith after having gone through a whole other faith life experience. The commitment to change, that decision, that kind of great leap of faith, seems to stir people, and I would certainly much, much rather work for in a building program with a small nucleus of converts than with a couple thousand old folks who just want the stained glass changed. I mean people who have been born and raised and have become, well, like Mary said, half the stuff we say we're sleeping on the other side of our eyes while we say it, you see. And it's that kind of thing. We're not even thinking. But these were terribly thinking people. And the fervor led them to search out the sources of their faith. We have then what we call in the early Christian life, the life of the early church, a cult of the martyria. A cult of the martyria. Martyr is a word familiar to us, but for some, it means something which isn't altogether true. It means, I think, for most of us, someone who dies for his faith. I think we made one out of Kennedy, Dr. King, that kind of thing. You have to die. Not entirely accurate. Martyr means witness. Witness. Someone who saw, who participated. And you've got levels of martyria. You've got the disciples who touched and stuck fingers in the side of the man God. You have got disciples of the disciples who followed, like Barnabas did, all of the guys who were there on that first-hand action. And you've
got primary, secondary, tertiary martyria. And these people just wanted to have some link back to the way it was. Well, one of the most important links, and that's why it's really kind of exciting to have a man in the village now who has the slides on these scenes of where Christ lived and worked. And maybe he can even help me out here if he would. It was very important, the location. The locations became martyrs. The witnesses themselves were actual geographic spots. Why, even today, I think if you would go over there, you might be a bit disappointed in Jerusalem, since it is one X marks the spot after the other, and it gets just a tad hokey. Priests and rabbis who will bless you if you wish to throw in a shekel, and you can go into the rotunda of the Anastasis, and there is an Italian marble slab with Deutsche Marks and guilders and all kinds of coins thrown on it. After you walk out of that, there's a little man that'll beckon you around to the back, and he says, "I got something here that isn't covered up with marble. It's the actual rock, and you may touch it, and I will bless you." Well, this X marks the spot thing is important. It's incredibly important. It's important. It was so terribly important as a kind of stimulus and activator to the early Christians that they made shrines at these sites. And so the site becomes a kind of iconography of place. Are you with me? Like an image, which is actually a location. The place saw what happened, and so we revere the place. Remember, we are talking about an Eastern concept. This is not a thing which had its origins in Rome. This is not a Renaissance manifestation. There is a bit of the Orient in this, and you've got to acclimate yourself to that. So where we begin is where the man began. This is the entrance to one of the gates in the walls, city walls of Jerusalem, the gate that leads ultimately to the beginning of the Via Dolorosa. And along this way comes all of these little shrines, all of these markings, all of the sites where X's have been put. Another of the threshing floors. This one happens to be, though, in the old city. And the threshing floor is where Solomon built his temple. It's where now a mosque stands over a site which is sacred to another faith. And of course, close by this is the Wailing Wall, which is important to other people of still another faith. A lot of things coming together in one spot, which in many instances predate the coming of Christ. But the city itself is incredibly important. And the people, the faithful that walk along the way. Now, I remember taking a tour of this place with 38 Valpo students one year. And after a day of doing the Via Dolorosa, after going and seeing David's tomb and seeing, oh gosh, the upper room, the tour guide's favorite expression is, according to pious tradition. And pious traditions that by the time the day was over, our kids were so grossed out that Jerusalem was a bummer. I mean, you know, it was just blech. Who needs all this? And every guy at every station of the cross has his hand out with a with a rosary or a Star of David or whatever you want, we got it here. And it was terrible. And we were all getting very, very sarcastic. We went to Capernaum and saw the one true kitchen cupboard of the Holy Virgin Mary. Oh no, that's Nazareth. Yeah, right. Nazareth has the one true cupboard. There's the one true well of the woman at the well. The one true woman isn't there anymore, but the well is what you see. What happens? I mean, I'm just talking to you. You're not even there, and it's starting to get at you, and it makes you nervous. It makes you very nervous. The problem is that when you're there, all of these sites have been searched for and looked for centuries. There have been a few squabbles over where the Garden of Gethsemane is and over where the actual tomb is. One guy came along and said it was outside the present city walls, and they practically crucified him for suggesting such a thing. So there's an awful lot of problems over just simple place. And I'll never forget that after this one day, a friend of mine, Dr. Walter Rast, who has done a lot of excavating over there, happened to be in Jerusalem at the time and came to our hotel on the Mount of Olives and sat down with the whole group. And he said, "You've walked on the place. Okay, maybe the dirt's been built up over a few centuries, you know, so maybe the Via Dolorosa is 20 feet above where it used to be. But you've walked there. Your problem is not just simply saying it doesn't matter whether X marks the spot or not. Your problem is whether you believe there was ever an X at all. Whether it ever did happen. Because that Via Dolorosa, the ox, the blood, the hash, the little roaches crawling in the flour and the sugar, the little runny-nosed kids with watery eyes asking for cigarette butts, and it can't have been that much different than the way it was." And he was right. Our problem was that the place actually messed us up and was beginning to convince us that there really never was such a thing at all. A guy with 12 crummy guys walking down the Via Dolorosa. I mean, there were people bumping into you all the time. What made one man special? We kept thinking, because Concordia Publishing House says that he walked down that street with a silver neon tube behind his head, and his feet were 6 inches off the ground, and he looked somewhat like a bearded lady, that you could tell, you know. You could actually tell. I mean, this guy was, you know, he floated a little. But it was not true. It just didn't happen like that. It was his word and what he did and who he represented that made the difference. So the power of the sight is incredibly significant, particularly to the early Christians. It's kind of interesting that the day after Walt Rast got done with us, we decided to go to the Sea of Galilee and just kind of clean off. We went for a swim. And that night, all 38 of us sat on the Sea of Galilee shore while the stars fell into the sea so profusely and fell so far down that you could see the reflection coming up from the water. And one of our big hooky football player types said, "Okay, God, okay, whatever you say." I'm not going to mess around again.
And we went back to Jerusalem, to the Mount of Olives Hotel, which I understand is no longer being run by the beautiful Arab Christians there. And that Sunday morning, had a Eucharist service on the roof at 6 in the morning overlooking the city. That was probably the most incredibly beautiful sharing experience liturgically that I've ever had. Place. You gotta know that it's important. But you also gotta know that it can kind of trap you a bit. The Sermon on the Mount place. Bethlehem place. You American? Welcome. Kavka by the Sea of Galilee. This is this loaves and fishes, or is this Peter's church? Yeah, right. I think this is Peter's church. Right?
Is the water really that clear?
No, it really isn't.
I don't think so.
Yeah. But good fish.
Yeah, Peter's fish.
The rock, you see it? They didn't just simply build a church and cover things over. But that rock was very important. Ignore all of the rest but that rock, because there was a little hanky-panky going on in the Baroque age, I think, a little later. Some of my ancestors came there a little later and dolled it up. That rock! The artwork that decorates these places in its original form is an extension of who these people were. This is kind of hard to understand for most of us. I don't think that we realize that what an early Christian was a Jew, or was a Roman, and they had a whole culture that they brought with them. I mean, they couldn't say, now that I've got a whole new faith that I am convinced of, I'm going to have to invent an art form to go along with it. They brought their art with them. They brought who they were, and they brought their building styles and everything else. So that you've got in an early Christian church, basically a kind of basilica form. The basilica was used by the Romans. It was used even by the Greeks before the Romans. And there are basilica-type buildings all over the place. I'll show you that basilica form in just a minute. But what it basically means is that you've got a large central area with a raised dais at one end, and that one end usually had a curved wall behind it. Some basilica had raised portions at both ends and a curved wall at both, and then you entered from the side. You had a kind of shed roof with open meeting work across the top, and then a clear story, and below the clear story, then the shed roof came down over a side aisle. Now that clear story, this little detail right here, and the spanning of this space here, how you handle the light and the span is actually the history of architecture in the Western world from this time until the Renaissance, and how we see that thing developing in the next 4 days, I think, would be interesting for you to look at.
What's that trap door?
Oh, the trap, that little trap door goes down to that mosaic I showed you before. The mosaic is on a bottom level, and these things were just built over the top in order to protect the...
Could I make a commentary?
Please. Yeah.
It fits in with your emphasis on the place.
Yeah.
Over ruins such as this and ruins of other churches, or I should say where new churches are built today, you have the ruins of two and three previous churches.
Mm-hmm.
The early Christians built structure over a holy place, that was destroyed. The Crusaders came in and built a church over the ruins of the first church. That was destroyed, and now the Christians today are building a church over the ruins of both of those.
That's right.
The places continue to be sacred.
This is an excellent point. Even for another reason, some of us tend to admire the longevity of the building programs in the old times. The Gothic cathedrals took 400 years to build, and we say, wow, now that was an age of faith. Well, it was an age of faith, but because it took so long to build, things kept falling down. Like Chartres Cathedral, for example, is about three or four building programs, one stacked on top of the other. A few things remain from one building program, and they add to another. As a result, I think for the student of art in early times, it must be quite a job deciphering the beginnings and endings of particular projects. And that, of course, is still going on. Now, of course, the thing they really wanted to see, the pilgrims, was this place. Helen, the mother of Constantine, did an awful lot on her own to build buildings over various sites in the Holy Land. She also went there to try and locate the true cross. The story of that is told in a marvelous fresco cycle by Piero della Francesca, and much of that becomes medieval legend. The story builds up over the ages to the point where fact and fantasy become intertwined. But nevertheless, they pretty well decide that this is it, and they build a church over it, a basilica form, with an atrium, very much like a Roman house would have, and then they have a courtyard behind it with a rotunda, called the Rotunda of the Anastasis, and it is there that the tomb is. Now, this is not like this today. In fact, probably one of the most disappointing churches in the world is this particular church today. First of all, because people are quarreling and arguing over centimeters of territory. The excavators and the renovators, I think they spent, clear this up for me, but some ridiculous numbers of years over who had the jurisdiction over a line that was running down the center of this building, which must have been no more than a half an inch wide. And it held up the restoration program for quite a long time. At any rate, the pilgrims came. They visited in droves, and they came from all over the place. That rotunda, here is an ivory carving of a little bit later, and it shows this particular rotunda form as a variation of the description of that Rotunda of the Anastasis. I show you this because it's important to see that the traveling, this constant influx of tourists into these places to pick up stuff and carry them back to their churches was the way in which the early Christian church developed an iconography. There was a way of describing things that people from various churches all over the world would understand. So whenever this particular building came forward, there was an element of, first of all, the resurrection. And that building form later became adapted as the baptistry form. The rotunda shape of the Anastasis becomes a style type for the baptistries of later churches. Here it is again. This is a vial, very small, tiny thing. It holds, it's made out of silver, and it holds oil. The oil comes from the lamps that were burning at the Rotunda of the Anastasis. This is a souvenir. Okay?
You can't go to Jerusalem and not get a souvenir. And on the souvenir, is a stamp that shows the rotunda of the Anastasis. It also has a picture of Christ on it. This particular picture was probably done by a Syrian artist, and so Christ is depicted as a prophet, as a Mideast prophet. His eyes are slightly almond, his nose is slightly spread, he has full lips and a beard, and a mustache, and long hair. That is the tradition that comes from Jerusalem and the Mideast, and it is in stark contrast to the tradition that comes from the West, particularly Rome.
Do you have an idea what the date of that is?
About 420, I believe. Now, the Basilica. The Basilica is, as far as the externals is concerned, very ordinary. A very simple building. It was the interior that the Christians were primarily concerned with. I remember the first trip I had looking at these things, and I passed up a tremendous number of them thinking they were railroad stations. There's your church that looks like a church, huh? Now, originally, this is in Italy. Originally, there was a wall atrium that came out to the front, an enclosure in the front here, and then this area here became a kind of a narthex. You can see the straight shed building, and it comes down, and then another shed comes at this angle, leaving a clerestory area there. This is Carlo Colonnari. Nuovo in Ravenna. And that's the interior. This is probably the nicest early Christian basilica still standing, although an awful lot of stuff has been done to change the form here. For example, the floors are all covered with marble. I have the conclusion in my own head that the early Christian church builders were some of the greatest rip-off artists that ever lived. They were stealing all kinds of things from the pagan temples. They of course, were still using the symbols that were being used then, but they took the style of columns, for example, and arches almost directly. The beams, wood. You have to get rid of wooden beams somehow and think of another way to span our churches, because an awful lot of fire happened up in here and destroyed a lot of churches in the city. The clerestory, the apse, and the nave. A very typical traditional basilica form. It is not a form that was precisely copied from earlier models, from Roman models. I think that would be erroneous to say the Christians just copied it right off the bat. They did some interesting changing to make it fit their ceremony. I haven't got the time, I don't think, at right now, to go into some of the ways in which the early Christians used the basilica. The early liturgical practices of the Christians, I think, might surprise some of you. The relationship of the confirmands, for example, who were there for instruction. If it was a cathedral, that is, if the bishop had his seat there, had his cathedra there, then he would instruct, and the confirmands would all gather in the middle, and the members of the church would gather in at the side. And at the end of their confirmation, then he would give the sign for them to be dismissed. Dismissa, yeah, which means you can go and we will now celebrate. And it's from that dismissal that we get the word Mass.
Why no feet?
I'm glad you said why. I'm glad you didn't say why no pews. It was a custom from even earlier times that at worship you did sit. For example, the Greek and Roman temples were kind of the reverse of this. For example, you had all the beautiful columns of the temple. The interior was packed with little sacred places where very few people were allowed to go. And so the people in the earlier times worshipped all around the outside of the building. Now this time you've got a building which on its outsides is really very unspecial. But inside, the decoration, the ornamentation, the coverings of marble and so forth compel people to come in and be enclosed by a sense of mystery. That cult of the martyria continues. For example, this is San Apollinare, who was a martyr, who died for his faith and who was a witness to some of the earlier people who were witness to some of the earlier people, etc., etc. And he is buried there in the center of the church. No, I'm sorry, he's not. On the side. Those are some people that came after him. These buildings were not built until there was a tremendous surge of people that wished to join and participate in the Christian faith. I don't think they had seats for one reason, because they weren't accustomed to it. That wasn't part of their religious practice except in the home. But I think for another reason, the press, the crowd of people allowed them to accommodate many more.
This wall is entirely covered with mosaic. Mosaic was a very popular early Christian medium because it was a popular Roman medium. The Romans covered their floors, their sidewalks, some of their walls with this particular media, and so the early Christians continued on in that tradition. But it was also a tradition which came in a different way from the East, once we have a Byzantine influence, when Constantine makes the church official.
Is that freestanding also?
That one up there, no. But the early church did have a couple laws about that altar, and one was that it did have to be a meter from the wall. It's and the priest would worship facing the people. It's also interesting to note that the early altars are not at all what we are accustomed to today. The early Christian altar was something like a butcher block or like a card table, a meter by a meter by a meter approximately, and they would have a thing that small for churches in which 10,000 people would be gathered. They didn't need an altar that was enormous. Valpo Chapel has an altar that is about 17 feet long. And I'll never forget Peter Hammond, the kind of firebrand from England who came to our chapel. We were so happy, you know, that he was there and he was looking around. We asked him what he thought of our altar, because it's a really special, grandiose altar. He says, it's really something. He says, where's your 20-foot-tall priest? In our own time, trying to justify why we have altars the way we have, there tend to be an awful lot of people who say that the reason for having altars like we have them is in memory of the early Christian the martyria, the catacomb, that kind of thing. But for anybody who's been in a catacomb, you certainly won't find altars that are 6 feet long carved out of Italian marble. And, you know, that whole business comes much later.
It comes at the time of the Crusades primarily, and at the time in which the church is looking for relics. The best relic you can get in a continuation of the cult of the martyria is a whole saint. I mean, if you couldn't get a hole and get a finger or an elbow, the trapezius muscle structure from St. Catherine of Siena would do just fine. We'd build a reliquary and decorate it and gild it up. That's okay. But if you can get St. Catherine in toto, wow! But where are we gonna put her? On. The people in Venice said, go to North Africa and bring St. Mark back. He's in the hands of the Huns, or in the hands of the infidels. Bring him back, and they bring him back. Where are you going to put St. Mark, for heaven's sake? Well, if we're still stuck with our little meter by a meter by a meter, St. Paul or St. Mark is going to have to assume the fetal position. In order to get in there. So what we'll do is stretch out our altar. So we stretch out the altar in order to drop the body of the relic in there. And from time to time, if we have a little money-raising word, check this out, they used to cut a hole in the top of the altar and during a part of the service, dip a handkerchief down there, dust off the body, and auction off the handkerchief as a relic. You see, and I don't know who we would get to do that here for, if we could get fire alarm systems and stuff with hankies like that, we could wind up with quite a show plate. But we're going to have to get a good relic first, and I hope nobody has anybody particular in mind. So that's the way we wind up with this long thing. That is, by and large, simplistic, I'll grant you, but nevertheless, the way we wind up with an altar which is actually a sarcophagus. It has really very little to do with your Christian attitude towards either worship or burial.
Certainly. We worship in churches that have freestanding altars, and we now say that, one, we are using the basilican stand, and two, are we back in stock?
You would be using the basilican stance, but I would say that the basilican stance is not back in style. And I'm going to get to that on Saturday night. Okay, that's the basilica. In fact, this is a model of the first St. Peter's in Rome. Very typical, much more elaborate, obviously. You had to have a bunch of altars. You had to have two side aisles. The clear story, you see a little tiny one up above here. Right up there, the shed roof comes right beneath it. So the interior of this church was pretty dark, but they still used wood to span the roof of the first one, and it burned down. St. Paul's outside the wall, so it shows you what happens when the Italians take a good thing and bow it up. But it's still basilica form. Enormous. Absolutely enormous. There are a few additions to this, and St. Paul's outside the walls did burn down, but they reconstructed it almost exactly to the dimensions and specifications of the old model. So some of these basilicas got very, very large. Now the cult of the martyria still continues to build close by, over the site of the burial place of a martyr. Of course, then you would have under the altar a crypt in which you could go down, have special celebration at the site of the tomb. Actually, this is an unusual church. This is San Lorenzo outside the walls in Rome, and it's two churches built built back to back. So you've got a church coming this way, going up to the altar, and this St. Lawrence was one of the most popular of the early Christian martyrs.
And so you've got another church which they built coming this way, and they opened the back wall and they got one real long way. The only problem is it's not quite lined up, and there's a little dog leg in the full light. It's kind of an unusual specimen. But the fact that it is built near the site, over the burial place of St. Lawrence, is very significant. And in the catacombs, always the incredible to me, but always the sign of hope. Always, always, always the sign of hope, of joy. There is never an evidence visually of somebody feeling sorry for himself or his faith. Now, I suspect in my own mind that we also have built up a kind of Cecil B. DeMille attitude about the catacombs, too. I can't in my own mind envision a Roman army as stupid as we tend to picture them, like Christians making fishes in the sand, you know, and saying, "I'm a Christian, don't tell," you know. "See the fish, and meet you tonight in the catacombs, pass it." 5,000 people go running down to the catacombs, and the Roman army says, "Wonder where they went." Actually, the catacombs were a kind of sanctuary. There was a way of going there and not being disturbed. It was a burial place, and until things got really bad, even though they were persecuted, you could run to the catacombs for high feast services, very special days, and not be disturbed by the people who knew jolly well you were down there singing your hymns and admonishing one another. So it's a little strange, the mythology that we build up about the early Christians. You gotta have a little common sense. But hope. Always hope.
A question on the previous one. What was that bird at the top?
Oh, I'm afraid that this is out of my territory, but I'll bet you it's not St. Peter. I'll just bet you anything it's not St. Peter. It probably has something to do about the morning. Get a load of this. I mean, these are two different, what you've got in the catacombs is basically graffiti. It's graffiti. And if you would check the subways of New York and other cities, you would find graffiti there. And it does not represent the highest art form of the land, not by a long shot. It's just somebody who is compelled to make a mark and does so, for reasons that are best known only to himself. But every now and then, you got somebody scratching on the tufa or on the plaster over the tufa, which is kind of a lava, which you can almost pick out by the handfuls. It's very, very porous. And they plastered it with lava and with plaster, and then they carved these holes into which they set the bodies. But look at it. This is an incredibly sophisticated and charming painting. The woman is an orang. Actually, it's not a woman. The guy couldn't help but make a woman. An orang is supposed to just be a figure standing and praying, and it represents a soul. The soul of a departed saint. Early Christian art, then, is very, very much sarcophagal, has to do with death, dying, and the next world, but in almost every instance you've got elements of hope. So that the sign of Jonah, for example, is very important, as you see across the second from the top panel. The three men in the fiery furnace, motifs that always speak of a going down and a coming up again, are very important to these people. The Old Testament was what they had. But they also had their art forms, their traditional Greek and Roman art forms. And they use to decorate their sarcophagi, their altars? This one, for example, which is probably the best known. This is one detail from the Junius Bassus sarcophagus, evidently a very wealthy Christian man, because he hired the finest artists that were available. But check how that artist had to, at this time, he picked Christ on the throne of judgment, held up by the Roman God of the sky. There was no other way. No other way. The little burial places like this, I always thought this was another garage. It was a garage behind San Vitale in Ravenna. And somebody, while we were visiting, asked if we'd like to go back there. And I thought, what in the world for, you know, to look at the tools and things like that. And we walked into that place, and it was just solid mosaic. Absolutely solid. 1/2 by 1/2 inch chunks of hand-blown glass set into cement. But now look at our Christus. It's Roman. It's not an Oriental figure. It's an Apollo figure. A completely different type of personage coming from a completely different place. The relationship of Christian art to its place of origin and to the time in which it was done is absolutely essential. That is the tradition of Christian art. Here is San Lorenzo again. St. Lawrence evidently died by barbecution. He was put on a grate.
Barbecution.
Motifs are Mediterranean. This is what we call a Mediterranean motif. This respective interlocking key is Greek. That is all mosaic. Every square inch. And in fact, the blue is more expensive to produce than gold, because it's made of cobalt. The whole scene shifts. I gotta hurry here. I don't want to keep you waiting. But the whole scene does shift, and the influence of art also shifts to Istanbul, or rather Constantinople, at this time. And Constantinople, the one city which is on two continents. A river separates it, and half of this is in Europe, and half of the city is in Asia. So, Constantinople on one side, Üsküdar on the other, and the great Justinian, the emperor, builds probably the most incredibly monumental. This man made the Medici's look like misers. And the thing we want to look at right now is the Hagia Sophia, the large church over there on the right. It was designed by Oriental people, and for that reason there's got to be a slight difference in the basilica format. The one big difference, of course, is the dome. But there was still enough of a Western tradition so that he puts a dome in the middle, but he puts two half domes, one on both sides, and kind of makes the thing long, even though it's got a dome over the top of it. This thing could house St. Peter's in Rome. Beauvais Cathedral, the tallest cathedral in the world. In fact, so tall that it fell down and they haven't been able to finish it. Would swing inside of this thing like the clapper inside of a bell. It is so immense that you don't even realize how big you are when you're in it. There is no way to judge human scale inside this building. And expensive. Justinian spared nothing
Oh, Solomon, I have outdone thee. That's what he said on Dedication Sunday. That's exactly what he said when he walked into this thing on Dedication Sunday. Solomon, I have outdone thee. He opened up marble mines, marble quarries. He opened up porphyry quarries. And when he was done using them for this one building, he dynamited them shut so that no other building would use the material that was used here. Everything you see is covered, not with just marble, but with matched, sliced marble and with gold. And the windows are covered with alabaster. Everything you see, matched marble. Carved, scripted, and mosaic inlaid gold. 22 karat gold sheets set in glass, and then cut up into 1/2 inch cubes set in concrete. The stress on the building was so incredible that the roof fell in and they had to redo it, the ceiling, the dome. And after they redid it, every single arch had its own tie bar just to hold the building together. Gold, capitals of columns that are carved, not just on, but in. The carving goes inside and around, inside of marble. And around with the tie bar. Everything you see here is marble and gold. Carved marble, porphyry, pearl, marble. The gold sheeting in here, you measure by the square acre. And that's the dome that hovers over the interior and sets on four immense piers. And the thing that the artist used here, which was one of the first and certainly the most ambitious use of it up to this time, was this particular little element right here, which is how they got from a square on the floor to a dome on the top without having the thing fall in. It's called a pendantic. And it, the best way I can describe it is that it is an old-fashioned diaper setting on one point that comes up and goes around and leans in at the same time. And at the one point steps on the pier, and these two other arms hook up with two more pendantics, and the four then provide a circle on which the dome rests. In order to lighten the circle, the artist, the two architects, hollowed it. So this dome is actually two domes, hollow, that thick. And windows all around, which give the impression of this thing hovering in space. And that's the mosaic stuff on the pendantium. That's the interior space. I wish that I could show you the color. The color isn't really quite right. I had to take these slides originally against the better judgment of the people who ran the place. And so I stuck it under my armpit, which accounts for the bluish cast. Actually, actually it's quite a creamy color. That's the dome.
How long did it take to build?
About 20 years. No, it didn't take that long. Altogether, from the beginning, through two building programs with domes falling down and being put up, a very short time, about 20 years.
What are the bars made out of?
Iron. The tie bars are iron.
How high is that, do you know, offhand?
About 183 feet, I believe. And that's mosaic. We'll talk tomorrow evening about Byzantium a little bit more, because it's a very exciting thing, and particularly the one element of Byzantine art which is, I think, most important, and that is the icon. And we'll try and get into Romanesque tomorrow again as well. Thank you very much.